So I'm here with Jeff Sachs, who is one of the great global thinkers on poverty, and somebody who is not only a great researcher, but also incredibly influential in terms of making a difference. Not many professors, Count Bono is a good friend, and do work for the Pope in preparing his encyclicals, but Jeff does that. So Jeff, I want to ask you, what got you into global poverty? You could have studied a range of things, you're a brilliant guy. What made you choose poverty?
Well, I wanted to do something useful, first of all. So I believe that this profession, economics, ought to be useful. It's not beautiful enough to be poetry or fiction, great fiction writing, and it's not elegant enough to be mathematics, and it's not rigorous enough to be science, so it ought to do something useful. And I had an interest in economic development from the earliest days, and especially from a trip to India that I took as a graduate student with backpack for a month. But it was really when I made a transition from the classroom into problem solving in Bolivia in the summer of 1985 that my life changed dramatically, because I saw the problems compellingly in front of my eyes. And after I got started in hands-on problem solving with governments or with communities, I never have looked back. It's basically 30 years of that work since then.
And you've tangled with many in the community, William Easterly most notably, but various others, over the effectiveness of aid. What statistics and stories do you point to on the value of foreign aid in making a difference in alleviating poverty?
Well, first, I'm very patient, and I give plenty of time for my fellow economists to correct their ways and to learn the truth. And I always encourage them, get out of the classroom and go learn something in real life on the ground, because I've seen it, what a difference it makes. In the last 14 years, my favorite success stories are in public health. I played lucky and fortunate in a role that I felt very honored to be in helping the scale up of public health interventions to fight AIDS and malaria in particular in the Millennium Development Goal period. And I helped design the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria. And there were huge skeptics at the time. Mr. Easterly said, if you give away bed nets, so they're going to turn into whatever, wedding veils, fishing nets. I don't know what he said exactly, except that it said people won't use them. Now, people want to stay alive, and they want their kids to stay alive, and you make available the tools to help people stay alive, and of course they're going to use them. And malaria, which is a very difficult disease to control, actually, because it transmits so readily, is actually down by 50% in sub-Saharan Africa from 2004-05 till today, one decade later. And this means hundreds of thousands of kids surviving each year who otherwise would have died in the past without the control. Millions of people are alive today because of that. AIDS the same way. There was no treatment of poor people back in the year 2000, but the Global Fund has made it possible with other programs to get around 10, 12 million people in developing countries on treatment. They're alive. The incidence of the disease is coming down now, in part because when people are treated with medicines, their viral load goes down and the disease transmits less. So all of this is to say, I've seen aid work dramatically in the face of skepticism. It's the real thing. Not all aid works. I don't believe in dumb aid. I don't believe in aid in cash and shoeboxes given to warlords in Iraq. That's another kind of aid from the U.S. Pentagon. I don't believe that they're exactly development geniuses. I'm talking about aid that's systematic, that's professional, that's targeted. We can help poor people to stay alive. We can help kids to get an education. We can help communities to get on their own feet. That's the real purpose of aid.
So Australia has just cut its foreign aid, at least relative to the trajectory it would have otherwise been on. And in general, you know, there are many Australians who have been supportive of that decision, or at least not opposed it. What would you say to those Australians who are sceptical of the value of our foreign aid program?
First of all, I find it very sad because Australia is a wonderful country. I have so many friends. I love Australia. And I expect Australia to help lead solutions in the world. It's one of the great countries of the world. It's one of the richest countries of the world. I don't think anybody gets a free pass on moral commitment to help improve the world. Certainly not one of the richest places on the whole planet. And so if Australians think their aid isn't working effectively, they need to try harder. Not say we're tired, we're cutting there. People die. There are 6.5 million children who are dying before the age of five. Use ingenuity, find ways. That's what I've been trying to do and having success, by the way. If we think about what we're doing, we can have success. And so I don't buy the idea, first of all, oh, there's nothing we can do. That's preposterous. I told the foreign minister, if there's a sense that we don't know where to invest, here's my email address. I'll help you use the money very effectively. And by the way, to honor Australia's values, because this is a country with great values. And so Australians want to be proud. They want to be out there finding solutions, and it can be done. That's the first point. Second point, it's said by this government, and I don't accept it for one moment, well, we're in austerity now, we can't afford it. That's preposterous, because the commitments that all our countries made was less than 1% of the national income. Of course, we can always afford 0.7 of 1% of our income. By definition, we can afford it. It's a very small amount of money relative to our national economy. But I have proof that it can be done, because I've worked closely with Chancellor George Osborne of the UK over the years. I went with him to Uganda when he was shadow chancellor, just before the elections. He saw on the ground the realities. He said, if we come to power, we are going to help take leadership to fight malaria. We're going to help take leadership to get our aid budget up to the international goal of 0.7. And he and David Cameron, Prime Minister, said, even though we're in an austerity period, we are not going to balance our budget on the backs of the world's poorest people. And amazingly, and it was tough politics, the austerity went into effect, but the aid went up. It didn't go down. They reached 0.7. And the truth of the matter is that while it was tough in some ways, it showed that's a party with heart, with spirit, that really is committed to the values, or committed that even in the midst of austerity, he would not cut the aid budget. And David Cameron said, we will not balance our budget on the backs of the world's poorest people. They've seen it through. It was tough. But actually, in the end, it was successful politics, because you see, this is a party with heart. This is a coalition that is doing good things. People feel good about this, that the UK is solving global problems. And I travel all over the world, and I hear wonderful things about that commitment. Yes. Countries around Africa and around Asia know that the UK saw it through successfully, joined what we call the 0.7 club, because there's only a few countries that have reached that goal. So it's not true that austerity means that the poorest of the poorest of the poor in the world have to take the brunt of it.
And to be clear, this is a Conservative government in the UK that's increasing aid as a share of national income.
It is indeed a Tory government. It is a Conservative government. But they know that it is national values that they're reflecting.
What do you think is going to replace the Millennium Development Goals? I mean, you were instrumental in creating them, but surely just extending the MDGs as they are wouldn't be the right solution. So how do we tweak them?
There's a process underway, which I like very much, from the MDGs to the SDGs. The SDGs are Sustainable Development Goals. And so the MDGs focused on fighting poverty, good progress, but not done. And certainly not success in every country or in every goal. But they did inspire action, and they did inspire institutions like the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria. And there's a general feeling around the world, this is working, we got to keep at it. But our problems are not defined only by extreme poverty, though that remains the number one emergency on the planet. Our problems are broader. Even our rich societies have lots of problems. We're not environmentally sustainable. We don't have an energy system that's going to keep us safe for the future. Many countries like my own, the United States, are in unprecedented inequality right now. Our society's coming apart at the seams. The top 1%'s got everything. The bottom half of the population is falling deeper into poverty, actually. And so the Sustainable Development Goals differ from the MDGs in two big ways. One is they are universal. They apply to all countries. They apply to Australia. They apply to the United States. They apply to European Union, as well as to the poorest countries. Second, the ambition of the SDGs is more holistic. Poverty is definitely part of the object. Fight poverty, eliminate extreme poverty, but social inclusion, narrowing income inequalities, promoting, of course, gender equality and the end of discrimination against minorities. This is a universal challenge. And environmental sustainability. That's going to be on the top rung right now because we're unfortunately wrecking the planet right now, so it's not good enough to go on in the direction. We have to find a new energy system, more sustainable farming, more sustainable and smart cities. We have to put all the pieces together.
And just finally, I remember one of your former colleagues at Harvard saying that they never had a conversation with you that lasted longer than about 10 minutes. You seem to travel to all of these countries. Well, you seem to travel to an amazing amount of countries. You turn out books faster than just about anyone I know. You're sort of constantly playing an influential role at that senior level. What gives when you're doing all of that? How do you manage to pack all of that in?
Well, I have found that there really are a lot of countries in the UN, and since I've been advising the Secretary General for the last 14 years, I haven't visited all of them, but I'm on the way.
Right.
It's about 131 countries at my last count, and I always find that it's absolutely fascinating because seeing the world from so many different perspectives is exhilarating. There's a little secret in this. I work together with my wife, who's a global health specialist, and I've learned an incredible amount from her. So these trips are not only lonely ventures, but I get to travel with my wife, and my eldest daughter is on the case. She's a specialist in sustainable investment. So it's kind
household
of a family business,
yeah.
And that makes it feasible, human, tolerable. But the truth of the matter is, you know, sometimes I dread a trip because every week, I can't even remember where I've been in the last 8 weeks, launching many projects. And I was in the Vatican, and then in Abu Dhabi, and then home for a day, and then flying to China, and now to Australia, and I fly home, and then I'm in Texas next Monday, and I'm in Cancun for 2 hours on Tuesday for the Global Environment Facility, and then I fly to Belgrade for 2 days, and then to Brussels, and then to Warsaw, and then to Łódź, Poland, and then back home, actually, for a little while.
Sounds now, like the worst Cancun trip ever.
So this is absolutely the worst Cancun vacation imaginable, and the truth of the matter is it was going to be a little bit of a Cancun vacation, and that's why I said, okay, I'll come, and maybe we'll take a day or two, just relaxation. And then came, you have to be in Belgrade the next day because we're having an important conference on the 100th anniversary of World War I, which is unfortunately, or fortunately, this is right now in Belgrade, which is obviously a pivotal place in the world, and on and on. It's a fascinating time. And what I was going to say, though, the schedule is a little bit out of control, but the times are so interesting and compelling, and our need for problem solving is so great, and there's so many wonderful people around the world. The chance that I'm sitting with you and having a great discussion is a wonderful thing. And you know, I find that sometimes I take a deep breath and okay, I'm back on the road or in the air, whatever one might say, but it's always exhilarating actually to be engaged in these issues and have the chance to see the world from so many different perspectives, and to try to be thinking all the time, the biggest challenge we face on this planet is how to cooperate with each other. And the fact of the matter is we're all in this together, and you see that very clearly. Mm. And yet it's so hard to get that cooperation. So that's a little bit of the business that I'm in, is trying to listen here, listen here, listen here, listen here. Okay, how can we come together in a way that is beneficial for all of those different voices and perspectives?
Jeff Sachs, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you.